And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre. So here in Massachusetts, your electricity comes out of the wall. Most people don't think much more about their electricity than that. But in fact, there's a big infrastructure behind energy production. Those people who provide you the electricity themselves break down into two big groups. On one side, there are these massive utilities that you hear about, Eversource and such, where you pay your bills. Massachusetts, having a long history of democracy, also has, in individual towns, small utilities that are specific to the town. They're called municipal light plants, or MLP for short. It's an acronym, MLP. Those MLPs, to my mind, they comprise something like 13% of the carbon emissions in the state of Massachusetts, 13, 10, 15%, that range. And they're an interesting place because they do different things. They're small. They're democratic because a lot of the MLP people are elected. The light board in your town is elected. So you have to find out if your town in Massachusetts is an MLP town. There's something like 40 or so of the MLP towns. But they're an interesting place for climate work. And that's why the Massachusetts Climate Action Network has been thinking about MLPs, municipal light plants, for the past several years. Recently, the Massachusetts Climate Action Network issued a report discussing MLPs and where they are, how much progress they're making, what kinds of new and interesting things they could do. And in order to discuss that report, we are thrilled to have with us today two people from the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. First, we have Sarah Dooling, who's the executive director of MCAN. How are you doing, Sarah?
Hello, Ted. I'm so happy to be back here with you. It's lovely to be here.
It's great to have you. And we have a first-time guest with us today, Mr. Logan Malik, who is the clean energy director at MCAN and has been, I dare say, influential. You can say more, Sarah, about who's most influencing the creation of this report. But it's a thrill to have you both here. Tell me, I tried to give a little bit of a story about municipal light plants. Please correct me. What did I get wrong? What did I get right? What do people need to know about municipal light plants in Massachusetts?
Oh, that's a great question, Ted. You know, when I first arrived at Mass Climate Action Network, I did some historical investigation into municipal light plants. And the first one was established in Wellesley in 1882. They've been around a really, really long time. And as you eloquently distinguished MLPs from IOUs, they operate very differently. These investor-owned utilities like National Grid and Eversource, they are beholden to their shareholders. And so they are really motivated by a different set of values compared to the municipal light plants. And 14% of the electricity distributed in Massachusetts is accounted for by municipal light plants. So they are often an overlooked part of the energy sector, unless you live in a community that has a municipal light plant and get your energy from these MLPs. So the companies like National Grid and Eversource are privately owned. These municipal light plants, these are public entities that are really about as community-owned entities. They offer people who live in a town with an MLP more direct control, as well as an opportunity to influence the kinds of programs, the kinds of policies that MLPs can offer their residents, can offer their ratepayers. And so MCAN, Mass Climate Action Network, we really value this particular model of a utility because they are designed to involve people, customers, residents directly in the decision-making about programs and policies and to prioritize the needs of the community and customers over making a profit. And unlike, this is the last distinction, and unlike these privately owned investor utilities, the municipal lighting plants own and can operate energy generation. So they have flexibility. They also have some autonomy because every MLP, every municipal light plant is different. And there are 41 of them across the state, and they're all unique. So one other unique aspect of these municipal light plants is that they are, unlike National Grid and Eversource, they're lightly regulated by the state. So they don't have the same opportunities to receive some of the state funding that, for example, National Grid and Eversource can tap into. The flip side of that is that they are more flexible. They can be innovative. They can pivot quickly. They can invest in different kinds of technology in a more rapid way and really work on developing more, both more ambitious and potentially more innovative approaches compared to the IOUs.
So question, well, number one, I was just going to say that when I was a kid and you borrowed money from someone, you gave them a piece of paper that said, I owe you 10 cents. And so every time I hear IOU, I think of being, you know, in eighth grade, settling up debts, right, before the onset of Venmo, right? But I just want to explicitly connect, IOU, investor-owned utility, is the big guy, is like Eversource. And my question is, a typical, let's say the largest MLP, you know, in terms of sort of dollar amount, has to be a tiny fraction of Eversource, right? Even the biggest investor-owned utility is tiny compared to these giant investor-owned for-profit utilities, right?
Absolutely. You know, these municipal light plants, you know, they're defined either as a constraint or as an opportunity, you know, on how many people live in their territory. They're often defined in terms of the physical geography of their districts. And some districts are way out in Western Mass, where, you know, there's more forested landscapes than there are ratepayers. And there's more forested acres of landscape as there are ratepayers compared to ratepayers. And some are in, you know, like Wellesley and Holyoke, some are in much more densely populated places. So that just highlights, yes, they are in terms of revenue, in terms of accessing funding, and in terms of the number of ratepayers served, they are smaller than these privately owned investor utilities. However, they are our preferred model because they open up access to residents in terms of how they can interact with the entity that's providing them power. And so, for example, residents can say, you know what, we don't want to invest in this dirty energy project. We actually want more clean energy that comes directly to us while not coming at the expense of making another community sick. So I think there are a lot more interesting opportunities for ratepayers to engage directly with light boards and with MLP staff in a way that those individuals in an IOU community, they wouldn't have that access. Right. To people involved in making policies or establishing programs.
There's this famous concept that the American states, the 50 American states, are the laboratory of democracy, trying things out. And I think in some way there's an analogy, right? The MLPs are laboratories for us to try out things that we would want the main utilities to do, right? And to sort of create this model that says, oh yeah, we tried this at this scale. Why couldn't we do it larger? Is that a good analogy or a bad analogy?
First off, Ted, so I'm going to take this, and it's so great to be on the podcast. I listen on a regular basis, and I love everything that you put out. You know, I think in many instances, it's a good analogy. I do think that there is a lot of flexibility that MLPs have. On the flip side, you know, there are real consequences and implications to the decisions that they made. So it's, you know, they have a real opportunity to be innovators, but there are different constraints that we, you know, and unique constraints that you have to be aware of nonetheless, as they are innovating and moving forward. And again, you know, because they are diverse, not, you know, it's not necessarily one size fits all. And the same thing goes with MLPs to IOUs. There are some things that MLPs could probably do way better than IOUs. And that is, again, as Sarah said, one of the reasons why we see them as the preferred model.
Super, super. So that was my interruption. I mean, what did – we've got the MLP, the Municipal Light Plant, the IOU, the investor-owned utilities. IOUs are big. MLPs, MCAN likes to work with. What was the nature of your interaction? What have you been doing with the MLPs? What kind of data do you collect from them and what do you do with it?
That's a great question, Ted. And for folks listening today, I want to emphasize that Mass Climate Action Network, you know, we're the one organization that really tries to support, highlight, lift up, but also track what these municipal light plants are doing to address the climate crisis. And one super efficient way of doing that is to look at all of the MLPs in a couple of different categories. We first published our MLP scorecard, as the report is called, back in 2019. And that was what I refer to as a rapid assessment. It was the first time municipal light plants had been evaluated as a group, as a particular part of Massachusetts energy sector. Coming in to the second report, we wanted to do things a little bit different, and that included enhancing data collection. So we collected different kinds of data, more data, but in order to make the report data analysis piece more transparent especially for the municipal light plants, we included a data verification process whereby the municipal light plant staff worked with Logan specifically on fact-checking and data-checking the data that they had shared with us. So that was during the report writing and analysis itself. At the end of the report process, we also worked with five expert reviewers, one of whom was a light board member. Others had are part of the private sector in terms of working on energy efficiency and energy transition, and others were advocates, and others were partners from similar kinds of organizations. So we really wanted to make sure that the report was transparent in terms of the analysis we conducted, and it was fact-checked and checked for tone and checked for readability. Because at the end of the day, this report is for advocates living in communities served by municipal light plant. However, this particular report, the second version, also addresses other groups that are decision makers related to funding, related to legislative efforts, related to what can happen at the local level. So while the report is really for our advocates, we also developed a series of recommendations that not only advocates can embrace and move forward on, but also light boards, the municipal light plants themselves, legislators, and other kinds of stakeholders that all want to accelerate how municipal light plants are responding to the climate crisis.
Let me go back. I want to go back to the concept of data collection. right? You made an effort to collect data about the utilities and then confirm that the MLPs and that they agreed there was good data, that you're all on the same page. But what's an example? I mean, tell me, is it number of people in the district? I mean, how many kilowatt hours you put out per year, right? Tell me, Logan, just so that, because when you say data, all of a sudden people's eyes glaze over, right? I mean, give me an example of the kind of data that you were trying to collect.
Yeah. So it was really varied, and it varied in kind of the sources that it came from as well. So we collected really a bunch of data around four main categories. So the first category was energy transition, data that tracked the progress that MLPs were making in transitioning their energy system away from fossil fuels and towards clean energy resources. The second category was energy efficiency, you know, programs in place that were enhancing the energy efficiency of the MLP. We looked at transparency and community engagement. That was the third area. And this is really, you know, these MLPs, why we love them is they're democratic entities, they're democratic institutions. And so, you know, how are they engaging their community? What are they doing to be transparent about their activities, their policymaking and operations? And then the final category that we looked at was, it was called MLP policy context. And that kind of reflects both the MLP and the local government's effort to create a policy context that facilitates the transition to clean energy. So, you know, when you talk about a particular data piece, it could be, is your MLP community a green community? Or it could be, you know, what percentage of clean energy is in your energy mix? And, you know, there's numerous different examples kind of that go along in that, mm-hmm. in you know, similar categories. I will just say, as far as what we did with the data, you know, we took this data and we then created a scorecard. We basically measured progress out of, you know, 0 to 100 points. So there were points available for each category: 50 for energy transition, 25 for energy efficiency, 15 for transparency and community engagement, and then 10 for that last one, that MLP policy context. We provided significant bonus points as well, you know, over 21 extra bonus points.
It's like your final exam in AP history, right? I mean, there's extra credit and there are different, right? So, but you're sort of, from what you're saying, of the 100 points, so the MLP wants to score 100 or more. 50 of those points would come from how they're doing energy transition, how well they're doing at that, right? Just the same as, okay, yeah, keep going. So I didn't mean to interrupt it.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. And, you know, we came into this really wanting to establish a framework for how we would be tracking progress in the MLPs, you know, not only in 2021, but also into the future. And so, you know, it's really important that when we look at these scores, it's not necessarily like, well, you score in the 90 to 100 category, so you have an A. So you passed and you did well. And then, you know, 80 to 90, a B. You know, we saw the variance of scores was, you know, it was across the board, really. And MCAN, you know, made a point not to classify, you know, what was a successful score, what meant that MLPs were you know, doing really well and that other MLPs weren't doing really well. The goal of this, you know, 0 to 100 is merely just for our advocates to understand where their MLP is relative to other MLPs, and then to understand what steps and what opportunities are available for them to then improve on that progress that has been made thus far.
The implication being the opposite of what I was saying is that your score is not, it's not like you run around with a star on your forehead because you got 100 points. I mean, that's great, but if you came in less, it's not ranking so much as informational about what your place in the world as an MLP and what interesting. Well, that's good. I mean, that,
So Ted, yes. So while we do rank the MLPs, I think at the end of the day, this report is really about understanding how each of them are working on accelerating their response to the climate crisis. And it's, so even, you know, for the top five, we know that they are, they have the most, they've invested the most in energy transition. Probably they are the most transparent about retiring RECs, for example. But that doesn't mean that their work is done or over. It's really an evolving way for advocates and other stakeholders to make sure that municipal light plants are continuing to invest and be innovative and really push on accelerating their programs and policies in addressing the climate crisis.
So the report is out. It's available on the MCAN website. Of course, we will put up links to that. There were conclusions, there were recommendations. Do you want to talk about conclusions? And then maybe we could get together later on and talk about recommendations.
Yes. Yeah, that sounds excellent, Ted. So as you mentioned, the scorecard is out. And, you know, we really did in this entire process, we wanted to emphasize not the scores, but the results that we found, the observations that we made, and then from that, the recommendations that can be drawn from that. And so as part of that, we identified 7 key conclusions. There are other conclusions that can be found in there. It's all in the discussion area. But we identified 7 key conclusions. And so the first of that, of those conclusions, is that we are seeing across the state of Massachusetts now that several municipal light plants are demonstrating clear leadership and ambition in working to transition to a clean energy future and working to enhance energy efficiency. There's no question that more needs to be done, as we'll identify in the other conclusions, but it's really important to acknowledge that, you know, there are some MLPs in our Commonwealth that are leading the way, both relative to investor-owned utilities and to other municipal light plants. And their success is a testament to the structure of and the model of municipal light plants, and the structure of a democratic energy system that is primarily responsible not to investors, but to the people that they serve.
That's great, Logan. So Logan just went over the first conclusion that we draw from our data analysis, and there are 6 others. And so we're just going to walk through them with some additional information so that folks listening today can begin to think about these conclusions and hopefully go to our website and check out the report. So the second conclusion is kind of technical. So I'm going to go over a couple of terms first for folks. And the first term is this conclusion is about how so many of the municipal light plants don't yet recognize a particular kind of accounting practice called retiring Class 1 renewable energy credits, or RECs for short. For those of you listening today, RECs, they are what's called the positive environmental attribute that's associated with different kinds of energy production. One REC is created every time a clean energy source generates 1 megawatt hour of electricity. So this is the definition. This is the technical definition of a REC.
A REC, a REC is not like an automobile REC, WREC. It's an REC, capital R, capital E, and it stands for, correct me, renewable energy credit. right?
Yes.
Big REC. That's what we're talking about here. And these are these little funny entities, little non-intangible things that are sort of like a stock that you own in a company, right? Anyway, sorry, continue.
That's okay. Very similar. So a REC, one REC is created every time a clean energy source generates 1 megawatt hour of electricity. So that means a source that generates a class one REC, that can include facilities that are presumably newer than some of our older polluting facilities, right? And that generate energy from wind, from solar, geothermal, and other sources like that. So that's a class one REC. So the way that we account for the generation of clean energy is through creating these RECs, right? We need to track clean energy generation. And the trick is that we can then decouple the REC from the energy generation. And when we decouple the REC from energy generation, decoupling means whether the REC is sold or not, that generation, no matter the source, once it is decoupled from the REC, cannot be represented as clean energy. So it's really about keeping track of these RECs as a way of accounting for the clean energy as part of these municipal light plants. So our report, we concluded that while the MLPs have made a lot of strides in developing and contracting for energy from clean energy sources, solar, wind, geothermal, this progress cannot reasonably be attributed to the MLP's energy mix because they're not retiring these class one RECs associated with these clean energy sources.
I think in one sentence, tell me if I'm wrong. If the MLP puts up a wind turbine, makes a megawatt hour of electricity, right? They get one REC. But if they sell that REC to some Joe Schmo somewhere who then says, I'm covering my coal-powered fire plant is now clean. Well, the MLP cannot claim the greenness of that power because the REC, the renewable energy credit, went to somebody else. And the coal guy is hiding behind that REC. And the person who made the electricity with a wind turbine has got nothing. Right.
Exactly. Yes, that's a great example of that. So in other words, if the municipal light plants, if they don't retire RECs for clean energy, then that means that almost 14% of our Commonwealth's electricity will not be transitioning to clean energy at a pace that needs to align with the rest of the state.
And just to be clear, when you say retire a REC, so that's like way that retiring a renewable energy means you just put it in a file cabinet somewhere. Whereas what the MLPs I think are doing, they sell that renewable energy credit because it has dollar value, and yes, they sell it to someone else, and that is explicitly not retiring it, right? Or someone else gets to retire it and claim it as their green goodness, right? Which is why the MLPs need to hang on to. Retire them, basically forget they exist because this is where you get into blockchain and stuff, right? You got to retire that, but we won't go there since I don't understand blockchain at all and not ready to. Okay. Continue on the second recommendation. Sorry for my interruptions.
Oh, no, that's wonderful, Ted, because some of these concepts, you know, they're not in everyday language, though, and energy can still be kind of this opaque thing to people. But another key finding that our report revealed is that the majority of these municipal utilities are not aligned with statewide clean energy levels as outlined in something called the Renewable Portfolio Standards. So again, these municipal light plants are regulated differently than the privately owned investor utilities. And municipal light plants are not legally required to meet these statewide renewable portfolio standards. And however, the fact that they are not required affects our overall state's ability to transition at the desired pace. So that's a key finding. And for folks on the call, a utility's renewable energy percentage is determined by the ownership and the retirement of these Class 1 RECs. And so these two conclusions are really related to each other.
Towards that end, and this one is a little bit less complex, but the third conclusion that we made is that many municipal light plants, you know, while they're not retiring RECs, they are providing a wide variety of programs that support their customers in adopting clean energy technology. And so some of the programs that we tracked and that we saw high participation in was the MLP Solar Rebate Program, which gives additional funding to residents who are seeking to install solar on their home. We saw net metering policies that were in place for residents, again, to take advantage of if they were installing clean technology in their homes and wanted to be, you know, reliant on that source. We saw a interesting and really exciting piece is we saw 100% renewable opt-in programs starting to come to take shape in several municipal light plants. And this is essentially a program where if a resident chooses to, they can pay an additional fee that then allows their energy to be covered by 100% renewable energy. And that renewable energy is basically tracked by the retirement of RECs, enough RECs to cover that resident's total energy supply. So that's something that we're really excited to see. We saw about 6 municipal light plants adopt this initially, and there's no question that more are very interested in this concept, and we're excited about that.
And that's that 100% renewable option, is that available under the investor-owned utilities? And then now that's transferring, growing among the pool of MLP, right? It's a similar thing. So if you've done that under Eversource, you're lucky because Eversource offered it. Now the MLPs are doing something similar. Is that a fair statement?
So I believe we're seeing 100% renewable energy programs in communities that have adopted community choice aggregation. So you know, cities like Boston and Lowell and other communities, they have adopted this program called community choice aggregation, which then provides residents with those options. Now, another part of the conclusion, though, and I think this kind of ties into what you were talking about, is while we are seeing a lot of these programs in place, we still see real opportunities to improve and strengthen the programs that are currently available. And one particular area where we saw this especially was in net metering. We monitored and kind of tracked various different characteristics of each MLP's net metering policy. And we found that there are opportunities for these MLPs to increase the size of facilities that would be eligible for the program, for residents, as well as especially to increase the amount of money that they are paying residents for the excess energy that goes back to the grid that basically is used by the municipal light plant. So, and this kind of covers several programs, but there are, you know, there is no question that these are being provided, but we still have more work to strengthen the programs and make sure they're truly incentivizing this new clean energy adoption.
And this segues very nicely into our fourth conclusion, which showed that on average, the percentage of total revenue that the municipal light plants spend on energy efficiency specifically is approximately 1/12 of the revenue percentage that the privately owned investor utilities allocate towards the Mass Save programs that also provide rebates and subsidies for energy efficiency. And while some people may say, oh, because the MLPs, they're so much smaller in comparison, and each MLP territory is different than the other, you know, this isn't quite a fair comparison. It is useful, however, to understand the relative investment that MLPs are making in energy efficiency. And investing in energy efficiency is a core climate mitigation strategy for utilities, privately owned and the municipal light plants. And the state's limited involvement in municipal light plant energy efficiency programs has practical implications, some of which support efficiency goals and others that don't. So on the one hand, current regulations allow municipal light plants to adapt quickly to community needs and priorities and present the potential for these municipal light plants to be leaders in innovating on programs and policies that prioritize energy efficiency. Yet on the other hand, with limited regulation, MLPs are under-resourced and they're not able to access state funding. And the absence of mandatory charges make it nearly impossible for all MLPs to invest a proportional amount of their resources towards energy efficiency programs at the scale and scope of IOUs.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a really important point that I don't want listeners, you know, to get overwhelmed with all these different conclusions that we're finding. The really big takeaway, one of them, is that municipal light plants are under-resourced. And I would say the bulk of our recommendations are really about include ways to increase their capacity to do the work, especially for energy transition and for energy efficiency. Okay. And I just want to mention another conclusion related to energy efficiency is that more attention is needed to increase access to these programs. So MLP's implementation of the practices and the policies that enhance access to energy efficiency programs are not really closely tracked, and they're not required to track access. And so our analysis indicated that while there are some voluntary efforts being made to track access to energy efficiency, there is huge room for improvement and expanding the implementation that of programs and policies that actually increase access to these programs. By access, I mean that materials about energy efficiency programs are in languages other than English, and that that the low-income residents are being specifically supported with increased rebates, that there is also targeted outreach to low-income residents. And when we think of the state trying to grapple with an economic recovery due to the financial hardships associated with COVID, these MLPs, we really want to see MLPs support individuals, support low-income ratepayers in particular, in increasing the benefits gained from participating in an energy efficiency program, either through getting a rebate, having an energy audit conducted, all with the goal of reducing their utility bill over time. So enhancing energy efficiency of homes and transitioning to clean technology, all comes together to make homes safer, right? Improve indoor air quality And so eliminating barriers to these programs is really important, especially for the low-income and non-English speakers in municipal light plant districts. And it's really part of an essential piece to how the state recovers from the economic hardships associated with COVID.
I think it's fascinating that the MLP topic leads you to these rather significant ideas, right, that have all kinds of philosophical discussion. We, you know, another 5 hours of discussion about, you know, energy, what the words are. You know, you say access to energy efficiency, but you're really talking about this fundamental justice around who gets to have clean energy. And it can't just be people who can afford a nifty solar panel on their roof, right? Or somehow you have to. So you should come back another day. We can talk about that at great depth because there's a lot there. It's a fascinating connection. It so much comes through this MLP topic, right? So many different ways.
Yes, and I am going to highlight another conclusion that our report contains, and that is that justice and equity. So energy justice and energy equity as part of MLP programming needs to be at the center of actually not only MLP programming, but their policies and how and their operations. And so things like setting energy rates, investing in energy infrastructure, and developing programs for ratepayers, that all has the potential to either make things worse, exacerbate inequalities, or alleviate these existing injustices, especially in these MLP territories. So presently, issues of equity and justice are rarely emphasized in MLP policy. That's beginning to change. Right, we're beginning to hear about some municipal light plant territories thinking about developing specific policies to really support low-income customers in their districts. So the MLP policies that are designed to mitigate climate change and to transition folks to clean energy, we feel quite strongly need to center ideas and practices and metrics so we can, you know, measure progress over time really on energy justice and energy equity. And failing to do so really has the potential to perpetuate the existing inequalities, the existing inequities. And what that means at the end of the day is that the people that stand to benefit the most from an energy efficiency upgrade are left out. Right. And that's not what we really want to see. We really want to have everyone be part of and have access to a clean energy transition.
I completely agree. I mean, I think there's the kind of a, you know, moral fairness imperative to, but it's but just from a completely, from a climate sort of scientist perspective, it doesn't matter if your carbon dioxide molecule came out of a poor household or a rich household, right? So you can't somehow pretend that you know, these issues can be shuffled off and they don't have consequence. We have to cut emissions from all homes, right? And so we need to be able to find ways to connect to every community, I think.
Yes, connect to every community. And I offer that really focusing on the low-income households first is super important because those are the households that, as we do this transition off of gas to electric, clean energy sourced electricity, that we don't want the folks that have the least capacity to be stuck with what we're seeing now, you know, high prices for oil and high prices for gas heating. And so there is a little bit of, there is a process of prioritizing the most vulnerable in this clean energy transition that we would love to see MLPs act on more aggressively. Mm-hmm.
So those are the conclusions.
There is one more.
One more. You guys have been busy. Okay.
And I think, you know, it's something that Sarah in many ways already stated, but it is something that we are, you know, we see clearly as an action item is that the state can do more to support MLPs in areas of energy transition and energy efficiency. And so that kind of spans the gamut of what we're looking at when we look at issues of equity, issues of environmental justice, increasing, strengthening programs, retiring RECs. There is more that we believe the state can do to support these efforts and to really ensure that MLPs are on track and that the state is on track to transition to a clean, just energy future by or before 2050, which is the very latest that we can, you know, transition to a net zero energy future.
Well, I think that you certainly have given me a lot to think about, and there's lots of content that you guys have been clearly thoughtfully reviewing the data that you've collected. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to come on and chat. What we will do is to put up links on the MCAN blog. Certainly the scorecard is got all of this stuff in it. It's all worth a read. There are various kinds of webinars and things you can view at the MCAN website. We'll put up all those links. Please go check it out. So that'll be there. If you have a question about this podcast, have suggestions for things that we ought to be talking about, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know the kinds of topics we ought to be considering. You're probably listening to this podcast on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps, which, of course, the most modern ones keep changing. I think it's iHeartRadio and Stitcher and Google and blah, 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 blah. We're on all of them. Go find us. You might have to look for Mass Climate Action to pop us up to the top of the list, but search for the Climate Minute. We're there. Your climate action for the week is to ask all of your friends to listen to us on their favorite podcast distribution app. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investments, and indeed a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Absolute pleasure, Ted. And for folks listening today, you know, really do check out the report. It's up on our website. If you have questions about it, please reach out to myself or to Logan.
Sarah, say the URL. I always put it in the it's massclimateaction.org, right? It'll there, and you bop around a little bit, you find it, right? It's under topics, or it's not hidden, right, Logan?
That's correct. And if you want to go directly to it, you can do www.massclimateaction.org/2021_MLP_scorecard. That's a lot to say. So you can just go to our website and it's right there at the top of the page.
Super. And thank you, Logan, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's exciting to come on for the first time.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.